Okay, so I'm going to try and keep this fairly informal in the spirit, in the direction, the spirit of the direction we've been heading over the last couple of days. And I've been asked to talk about mantle plumes from the geodynamic point of view. And so I'm going to touch on a few things. I don't know if we'll get all the way through all these topics, but I'm going to touch on each of these topics as a kind of sampler of some of the geodynamic issues. Sorry? Oh, I'm going to use it. So I'm going to use it soon, and then I can put it away. I'll use it for the first part of my talk. So I think we've heard a little bit about plumes from various points of view. If you look at a sort of introductory geology textbook for how the dynamics in the interior of the Earth works, you're likely to see something like that picture up on the upper right. That's kind of your typical typical picture. And they may even include an explanation of convection along the lines of this cartoon, which has a little Bunsen burner with a jug of water sitting on it and the hot material rising and the cold material sinking. And that there must be a stick somewhere. Yeah, it is. But it's characteristic of, you know, many things. And that's fine. But it basically, you know, shows this sort of circulation pattern. And I think, as you've been seeing over several days in the last couple of weeks for the students, the reality is expected to be considerably more complicated than that. So what we're going to focus on is what happens, is the possibility of these upwellings, is what happens with the upwellings. And the way this is drawn, it actually doesn't necessarily require, basically the way this is drawn, the upwelling occurs right underneath a mid-ocean ridge. But I think the general sort of view now is that the mid-ocean ridges are randomly sampling. There's an upwelling underneath the mid-ocean ridge essentially in response to the spreading of the plates, but that doesn't necessarily extend to an overall sort of two-dimensional circulation pattern like this. On the other hand, when you have heat loss, as we've heard already, when you have the core heating the mantle, it induces a thermal boundary layer at the core mantle boundary. And under the right conditions, that thermal boundary layer will become unstable and will start to rise. And that's what gives rise to the idea of mantle plumes. So from a, let's see, change this around in response to some things that have been said here. So this is the kind of fluid dynamical picture of a mantle plume, and I have a sort of old cartoon of what that might look like, or not a cartoon, an old calculation of what that might look like in models. It's very simple, a very simple suite of calculations. And so here we have a mantle that is entirely heated from below. There's no internal heating in this, and cooled from above. And there are three different calculations here, and you're seeing these little small multiples are basically a series of time snapshots here. And so what you see is that these are temperature contours. What you see, these on the right, sorry, are temperature contours. What you see is basically a small instability developing, starting to rise, and then spreading out as it hits the surface. And that's a sort of that's a kind of classic picture. This is easy to produce numerically in a model. It's easy to produce, and you know, it's been produced many times in laboratory experiments as well. The difference between these three panels is that the top one has a uniform viscosity, and the bottom one, the viscosity becomes increasingly temperature dependent as you go down on in the rows here. So the bottom one is the most strongly temperature dependent. And one characteristic of these temperature dependent calculations is that you get this characteristic very large mushroom-shaped plume head accompanied by entrainment of some mantle material. And as it rises, it gives you somewhat complicated, might give you a somewhat complicated geochemical picture. In fact, the contours on the left here are contours of a of the concentration of a dye that was introduced into the bottom, essentially the equivalent of D double prime, and you can kind of see it rising up. On the left, you can see that it's not mixing very much, it just goes up, and on the right, it's stirring around and giving this characteristic spiral pattern, and you're getting little chunks of that dye around in the plume head. So that's sort of a one picture of how this works. Now, you can see many different instances of this. You've probably seen a picture like this. I sort of find this interesting because this was actually based, not this particular model is based on trying to understand, I think, salt domes, not actually mantle plumes, but it illustrates the basic characteristics. Here's a viscous fluid with some material being ejected, buoyant material being ejected, and it's starting to rise. And again, you can see the formation of that characteristic plume head here. And these guys have summarized sort of how this works with these three diagrams. The mushroom-shaped plume head is what you have when the plume material starting out is less viscous than the surrounding material. It comes up and encounters the more viscous material and it gets shoved off to the side, and then you get the circulation and entrainment. If you have uniform viscosity material, you get a spout shape, and if you have more viscous material in the plume, you get a balloon with very little entrainment. So these are just sort of different basic sort of fluid phenomena that you see when you start looking at plumes. In fact, we did a study of this, plume heads, a number of years ago with Scott King, using an axisymmetric calculation, because that's what was possible to do at the time with the computers available at the time, and basically looked at the size of the plume head that develops compared to the tail that follows it, and basically looked at how that increases as you increase this is an increasing temperature dependent viscosity in this case. So this is an axisymmetric calculation. You'll notice that we've heated a patch at the bottom here. We have not heated the entire base of this axisymmetric core mantle boundary. If we did, we might end up with an instability again on the side, which would be more crown-shaped. And so we wanted to do a very simple numerical model just of a plume, and so we tried to isolate the plume-type characteristics from all other sorts of characteristics. And that's something that you'll notice some when you're trying to look at fluid dynamic models of this, that our goal is typically to simplify the phenomenon enough that we can study it in a clear way. So we want to typically isolate a lot of the complexities that we deal with in the geologic world, throw them out, and try and look at a single suite of parameters or something like that, and basically try and get at the essential physics of the problem. So that's what we were trying to do here, is get at the essential physics of how temperature-dependent viscosity affects plumes. Okay. So I'm not going to talk much more about these plume heads, except to say that they have been associated in some cases with large igneous provinces. So you can imagine that when this thing gets to the top, it's just a big whopping thermal anomaly in the surface. And so some people have attributed very large episodes of volcanic activity to these things. So, okay, well, that's more of the same. I'm going to go back and forth for a minute or two here. So, one point that I want you to take away from this, the students in particular who were in the short course, is that when we use the word plume, mantle plume, we often different people coming at this problem from different disciplines are sometimes talking about different things. So this terminology has been introduced from different points of view, and it has evolved, as terminology tends to do. And as a result, you want to be sure when you're hearing someone talk about a mantle plume that you know what it is they are referring to and what it is that they mean by a mantle plume. This can be a little bit confusing because the phenomenology that people are talking about overlaps. So the terminology overlaps, but it's not. Sometimes we have different meanings for the same word. So when I talk about a mantle plume, a plume, when I talk about a plume, I mean that I'm thinking primarily of a boundary layer instability that rises or sinks. You can have a cold plume. If you have a cold thermal boundary layer that gets too thick and too negatively buoyant, it will sink, and that could be called a cold thermal plume. Likewise, when you get a hot thermal boundary layer that becomes gravitationally unstable, it will rise, and that will give rise to a hot, buoyant plume. And if we apply that to the mantle, then we would expect that where there are boundary layers in the interior, we're going to see, if they become unstable, we're going to see a rising or sinking boundary layer, and that's going to be a plume. So that's strictly based on looking at the gravitational forces at play and basically looking at where instabilities rise. But when that term has gotten applied to the mantle, it's basically used to describe the It's used to describe typically the origins of hotspots, some hotspots in particular like Hawaii. And then we start to introduce a whole lot of other observations that characterize mantle plumes. And those may or may not be related directly to this boundary layer instability problem, right? So that's the crux of the problem that we'd like to know the answer to is, to what extent are the processes that we see on the surface, such as hotspots, related to something like a boundary layer instability that's rising? And where is that boundary layer, and where is it, you know, where is that instability rising from? And that's at the core of a lot of the sort of discussions you've been hearing over the last few days, and probably will continue. So I wanted to show this figure, which is basically taken from, this is taken from Bill White's group at Cornell, and this is taken from a review paper by Farley et al. And these are basically a couple of different views of the geochemical variations that one sees in ocean island basalt versus mid-ocean ridge basalt. So the top here is basically a histogram of helium isotopes, and you've heard about helium isotopes, and the MORBs tend, there's a little bit of spread in here as Don Anderson will probably point out later after seeing me show this. So there's a little bit of spread here, but basically most of the MORBs fall into a fairly narrow category, whereas the ocean island basalts have quite a diversity of helium isotope ratios. And as a couple of people have pointed out already, we see a great deal of heterogeneity that ranges in scale. So this is a kind of histogram of global scale heterogeneity. But if we also look kind of locally in the Galapagos Islands, these are strontium isotope contours, and it doesn't really matter what they are saying for my purposes here today, but just the fact that they vary so much here, and you can make these contour maps of them, which these authors attributed to basically the mixing that might go on between the plume as it entrains material, and as that material comes up, we see sampling of a mix of source material from the thermal boundary layer with whatever characteristics it has, and the surrounding mantles. That's all mixed up, and then what you get at the top is a complicated mixture of the two things. So one of the questions we would like to know the answer to is whether we can attribute some of these variations to more shallow scale processes or to more deeper scale processes. That's a question that we'd like to know. Are we sampling a complicated boundary layer, the sort of thing that Don was talking about yesterday with the narrow core of a plume giving you one signature and then the other stuff coming up as well, or are we sampling something more shallow? So there's a question for you to answer. Okay, we've already seen those, so I'm not sure I'm going to talk too much about that. We've also seen this, this is again, it's sort of a cartoonish summary of some observations of superplumes, okay, under the Pacific and under Africa. And you've seen these shapes before, the seismic anomalies that occur. And these are often called superplumes because they seem to resemble the sort of large upwelling that I showed you in the model of a boundary layer instability. And so a question is whether these have that kind of dynamic origin. Are these an incipient upwelling? Are they an active upwelling, or are they something else? Okay, so these are called superplumes because they have that temperature anomaly that you would expect to see in a plume. The question is, what's the exact dynamic origin of these things?
Super implies that they're extraordinary, mm-hmm. unnormal characteristics.
Yeah, but with because they're exceptionally large and because the seismic anomalies are exceptionally strong.
That wouldn't make them analogous to the earlier calculations you showed of boundary layer instabilities with very narrow.
Would you make them analogous?
3,000 kilometers across.
Would you make them analogous to the large mushroom plume head that starts to form at the very beginning of the onset of a plume?
Doesn't the plume head grow as it rises?
Yeah, it does, but it also starts up big, bigger than the later plume gets. Let's see. You're right, I don't really show that very well. Whoops.
The mushroom of the super plume would be enormous.
It would be enormous, yeah. if that were the...
Anything you could imagine.
Well, I guess the crucial question is whether you should think of what people call superplumes as just thermal things, or whether they're spreading out because they're trying to go through a compositional gradient.
Yeah, that's right. That's a
surface spread.
Right. But that's a fairly large object there. As it launches, it grows as it goes up, but it's a fairly large object even when it starts.
Yeah, in a seismic imaging, essentially what we call superplumes, I guess, for some sort of rarity, covers many of the hotspots. So if you, for example, superimpose the dots that represent the known hotspots, for example, the Pacific Blue Group probably contains 15 of them.
No, I don't have that particular picture, I don't think. I might.
So, you know, there is not one-to-one analogy between this type of calculation.
But also, I mean, you say big mushroom, but I'm looking at that and I still see something that's only 3 or 5 times wider than the thermal boundary difference.
Right.
The thing that the seismologists are calling such plumes are a factor of a few larger still.
Mm-hmm. So. I'm not arguing that it is a... I'm not arguing that it's a mushroom. No, definitely not. It is an important issue because
people. I think some people think of superplumes as if they were.
That's right.
These things.
Right.
It seems to me that they're more than that.
And that's why I wanted to point out that this terminology, in some sense, has several meanings. And I think the people who are studying these structures. I think would agree that there is likely a strong compositional aspect to those structures. In other words, they are not simply a thermal boundary layer instability. But I just want to make sure that there's, you know, some clarity in the use of that terminology of plumes and superplumes.
Plumes were invented as an alternative to the normal very large scale mechanical convection of dimensions.
Exactly.
Right. So it's really very misleading to use the same word.
But
you're trying to compare them with are heated from below, mm-hmm. no heating from within. Do you really think that the core is providing all the heat and that there's no radioactivity?
No, I don't think the mantle's heated entirely from below, certainly not. But this is where, you know, this is the starting point. This is the starting point for this. And the fact is that the terminology exists, we have to work with it. So we just have to be clear about what we're talking about. That's really my main point about that. That's right.
In general, so you cannot just change it to something else. If it's blue,
they're buoyant. Yeah. However, that's right. We can't change the fact that this terminology has evolved as it's been applied to mantle structures and mantle, you know, basically mantle dynamics. And so but we do need to be clear about what it is that we mean each time we refer to this thing. That's right. If you had heated only, if you were only heating the mantle entirely from within, you wouldn't get that boundary. There would be no boundary layer to have an instability from. And so one of the things we were talking about at dinner is, and I'd be curious to hear what the other geodynamicists have to say about this, is what amount of basal heating do we need to produce something that does look like a plume? And how would you tell? Because in the case where we have entire, if we were to do a mantle convection calculation that had entirely internal heating and just cooled from above, you would get a boundary layer at the top that would become unstable and would circulate. And as a result of that, the mantle would have some return flow. So there would be material coming up. It wouldn't have a sort of focused structure. If you have a little bit of basal heating at the bottom, you may get these boundary layer instabilities that come up. They might be very weak compared to the rest of the mantle. And in fact, one would expect, even though these hotspots are very fascinating features, they're actually fairly minor from the point of view of driving the dynamics. They don't have much of an effect on the overall energy balance of the Earth. They're just very interesting. So, at what point do we suppress them completely by having most of the heating being internally heated? Okay, that's a little bit of a diversion. So this is Cordio's plot of the of the hotspots, which he's actually categorized into three categories. And maybe since I'm there, I'll just, whoops, another planet. Maybe since I'm there, I'll mention this is one sort of cross-section of the Earth that tries to address some of these questions. It's a cartoon again, and basically has a superplume with little plumelets being launched from it, and then some primary plumes that are coming from the core mantle boundary, and then some things unlabeled here that are basically driven by processes in the lithosphere. So there's in this sort of classification, the zoology of plumes, I guess you'd have sort of three categories and try and sort them out in that way. The three categories are, in this particular model, this is my model, so we have a superplume that's launching small plumes from it. Okay, so the Pacific would be the kind of type example where you have a lot of little hot spots at the surface. They would be coming from this large upwelling, this dome, and I'll get into the dome structures in a couple minutes. This thing is not going to go all the way to the top because it's presumably got some compositional density element to it that keeps it, suppresses its rising all the way to the top. But it's hot enough that when it reaches the transition zone, it launches small upwellings from there. Then you have a handful of plumes in this model which come directly from the core mantle boundary, sort of primary plumes that are so that sort of structure that I showed in those numerical models. And then you have a few things that are somewhat driven by base lithospheric processes. So it would probably be seamounts and that the like.
In this picture, the plumes look like plumes.
Yes.
And so you've got two scales of plumes. You've got something coming off the deep mantle that's got sort of, you know, skinny thing, and another thing that's really wide. What
right.
Variation?
Oops. Messed up the room there. Sorry.
Well,
yes.
I don't know where we've been here.
Yeah, that's right. It's all on the web anyway, right? Is it preserved for posterity?
So. What difference in conditions, characteristics, or properties are going to give you one set of plumes that are 10 times skinnier than the other?
Sorry, Dave?
That's right.
But the difference in this
classical model
coming from the same place here.
Yeah, but the difference in this case.
How could you have both planes?
Right.
The difference. How to choose, but how could you have both?
Well, I think it would be very difficult to have both. Okay, I'm very curious to see that. In this case, what they are looking at, what they think is happening, is that this is essentially a thermochemical structure. So there's some compositional effect here that this stuff is more dense than the surrounding mantle, more intrinsically dense than the surrounding mantle. It's also hot, so it tends to dome up. And there are experiments that we can look at that talk about that. So this tends to dome up, but it's still intrinsically more compositionally dense, and so therefore it doesn't make it to the top. When it gets to this barrier to continuing to rise, then you get a boundary layer instability at the interface, and that will tend to launch some plumes. Whereas over here, this dome hasn't happened, and so therefore you have the boundary layer instability developing at the bottom. That's what they see.
The material over there has to be not intrinsically more dense, it has to be...
Yeah, either it's just sort of normal mantle.
Normal or intrinsically lighter?
It's normal. Mm-hmm.
So really, it shouldn't be showing the same color, basically. There should be showing compositional differences along the V-double prime region
right
down there that correspond to those things.
This isn't my paper, I should say.
No,
so,
I'm just
so I don't know why they chose the colors that they did, but it's fine.
You need at least one more color in that.
That's right. We need at least one more color in that. Okay. So since we're there, just organizing my talk around what you guys want to hear. It is fun, actually. So since we're there, let's talk about those sorts of things. So now I'm going to try and avoid showing my own cartoon because I'm sure you've all seen it so many times you're sort of tired of it. But this is that cartoon was based on these sorts of experiments, which looked at. Okay, now I'll fold this down for the moment. Which looked at, maybe, Oh, thank you. Thank you. These looked at thermochemical convection. And this was published in Nature, and this Anne DeVise group also has some papers in Journal of Fluid Mechanics. They're quite interesting reading, because when you read these papers, you realize that these are quite challenging experiments to do, because they require basically setting up two layers of fluids. The two layers are represented by the blue dye and the clear dye. And these two layers are different densities, and they're also different viscosities. And so this is sort of a sugar syrup, but she's also introduced some polymers in there to be able to control the viscosity independently of the density. And so this is she's able to vary both the density and the viscosity of the two fluids independently. And then the tank is heated from below and cooled from above, and basically the convection is set in motion. And what you're seeing is three snapshots after the system has evolved for a period of time. And the top one is strongly layered. Now, it may actually even look like it's two different tanks, but that middle interface there is the interface between the two fluids, and you can sort of see this downwelling, this light blue downwelling, and then up there this light upwelling. You can sort of see the upwelling plume. So basically, you have layered convection in this because the density contrast is so strong. This middle experiment here has mixing, ultimately mixing, and so that you can see this upwelling, which is in training as the blue material is coming up, and gradually this will stir and become a uniform blue. And then this lower picture is the one that partly inspired that cartoon, because it's in what she calls the doming regime, where you have domes of hot but intrinsically dense material coming up. And sometimes, although in this picture you probably can't see it, sometimes you can actually see little plumes launching off of there. That's similar to a picture you showed, a picture, I think Don showed a picture of Michael Manga's Angelinox calculations that also have not quite doming, but a sort of piles forming with little plumes forming off of it. This is a very time-dependent type of situation. So essentially, these domes don't stay in place. They go up. There's one that actually makes it all the way to the top. Then they sink back down again, and it's a very dynamically changing situation. These are they're laboratory experiments that are entirely heated from below. Probably shouldn't talk about this because the author is in the audience, but essentially you can see some of these sorts of things in other numerical experiments. So this is work by Hansen and Ewan, and they varied some of the properties with depth. But the reason I'm showing you this is to show you again this formation of these piles with plumes sort of launching off of the top of them. Now what you're not seeing here is plumes forming over here, right? You're not seeing that. We don't really see that so often. This is a work by a student of mine that is basically, you know, showing the same sort of thing. We're just seeing temperature here, but there was a density contrast. There's two layers here, and this more or less is the interface between the two layers. And in this case, we were varying the viscosity. We were looking at uniform viscosity on the top and temperature-dependent viscosity at the bottom, with increasingly strong temperature-dependent viscosity. And what you're seeing here is, again, some little plumes being launched from the top of the pile that forms. And one thing I'd like you to notice about this is that there's an upwelling in the basal layer underneath the upwelling that's launching off of this. So if you were to just draw a cross-section of temperature here compared to, say, here, this would look like a hot channel all the way from the bottom to the top, and there'd be a cold channel all the way from the top to the bottom here. But there's no mass transfer, virtually no mass transfer across that interface. So what you're seeing is essentially heat going up, but mass being inhibited from transferring across that boundary due to the density contrast between the two materials.
What was the density contrast? Was it set up to be Earth-like?
This was set up to be marginally stable. So this has what's called a buoyancy ratio of 1, meaning that that the effect of composition on density in this is the same as the effect of temperature on density. It's not Earth-like in many respects. It doesn't have depth-dependent properties, unlike the work that Dave will show later. And it does not have well, it's not spherical, it's 2D, you know, that sort of thing. It's heated from both within and below.
So with respect to the semantics used by your analysis,
mm-hmm.
we're starting to lose the distinction between upwellings and plumes. Are all upwellings plumes? Because this looks like it's driven by subducting high viscosity material.
But these upwellings...
The return flow, and the fact that that return flow is sort of concentrated, it may have had some origin in the boundary around stability.
Yeah.
That makes it a plume in your mind?
Yeah.
So everything that upwells is a plume?
No. Not really.
No.
Yeah. It's got to be driven by, no, it's not a semantic issue. It's driven by buoyancy forces. If it's driven by buoyancy forces, it's a plume.
The difference between continuity and vorticity generation is enormous. Mm-hmm. That's not a semantic difference.
No, it isn't. Exactly. That's a good way to put it. I'm sorry. Okay, well, driven by, you know, by, I mean, I think of plumes as being driven entirely by what happens at the boundary layer, and then their location, the location may be driven by what's happening at some other boundary layer. So,
you said the new model, this heat
this particular model. The proportions. Okay, let's see if I can remember. We ran a whole lot of different models. I think in this case, about 75% of the heat was from within and 25% from below, something like that.
Did the buoyant plumes coming from the bottom start before the cold plumes coming from the top came down and cooled off the stuff just above the hot layer?
No, everything started at once.
Looks like you got better developed cold plumes there than you have hot plumes.
That's because the basically because there's heat from both within and below, right? So the heating from below is in some sense less important than the heating from within in this particular case. So actually, that actually raises a point because that it's, you know, it's worth mentioning a detail of these models. How do you start out? I mean, I mentioned that the laboratory experiments are difficult to do because you have to set up this, you have to basically pour this layer of stuff and wait for it to stabilize and pour another layer of stuff on top of it and try not to mix them while they're pouring and things like that. So that's very difficult. In this case, we can do whatever we want, but we have to choose what we're going to do to start the model out. And so this is, you know, directed a little bit at the people who've been in the class for the last 2 weeks. That what we did in this case, I don't have an initial picture of this, but we started out with a barrier, an absolute barrier, to mass transport across between the two fluids. So it's like we had a little, you know, plastic sheet between them. Heat was allowed to transfer across there, but not mass. And we let the calculation run till it reached sort of a, you know, equilibrium state. And then we remove that barrier and we allow the two layers to evolve, the topography on the two layers to evolve. So if we just, you know, there are various ways you can start a calculation, and those different ways of starting something can have an effect on, for instance, how rapidly this sort of deformation happens.
Get a stronger plume if you cool the stuff right above the boundary layer, so that there's a larger
buoyancy
contrast
between those. Then you'll get a stronger plume. Notice that in the top one, the upwellings and the downwellings are essentially mechanically coupled, right? Where you have a downwelling, you have an upwelling below it, more or less. But in this case, they are not correlated in that way.
Is this very strong downwelling at the bottom picture, at the edge, is sort of artifact of
temperature dependent conditions? No, it's an effect of having temperature dependent viscosity. I think it organizes itself, and this is has wraparound, so it's periodic boundary conditions. So that's probably why they're there.
How about all the other downwaves?
Yeah, they do. That's right. The flow likes to have a longer wavelength.
Have you done a calculation with an even wider box? It looks as though it would be nice to do it.
Yeah, I know, it would be. No, we haven't. We could. Very easy to do that. We experimented a little bit with different widths of boxes, but it would be nice to do that.
Well, one more point about this figure. I kind of like this figure, but if you go back to the seismic models,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Chemically distinct material might be analogous to the low velocity zone under Africa.
That's right.
Would you call it a superplume? Would you call that a superplume, or would you call that?
Wait a minute. I didn't call that a superplume. I quoted people calling that a superplume. I would call this.
We appreciate if you called it what you like.
It's fine. We can call it a superplume. In that case, this would also be a superplume. This would be basically the same thing.
Right, but dynamically, what is plume-like about that structure?
This, call it a superdome.
Call it a dome. Okay. Let's call it a dome. I'd prefer to call it a dome. Yeah. And we should call them dome, but okay, we should call them dome structures. That's right. If you want to be really, if you want to sort of really create a problem, though, I could point out that the word dome is already also taken with it. It also has a dynamic implication. She uses the word dome to describe this structure. So if we start using the word dome for those structures, we're going to be implying this kind of dynamic origin for it. When you use a word, it would be different from plume. I mean, the difficulty that I'm pointing out is that when the words we're using to describe a structure in the mantle often have a dynamic implication. And when we call it a plume, we call it a dome, we're implying it, without even necessarily meaning to, we're implying a dynamic process, and we just need to be careful.
I think this is a key point. You said yourself already getting people to use the word
plume. To mean multiple things.
That's what an enormous amount of people. And to use terms have perfectly fluid on any connotation just to describe a structure really does imply a source.
Yes, right.
Now, plume is a well-defined terminal, fluid dynamic term.
Right.
I think dome is. Dome doesn't imply any fluid dynamics whatsoever. It's been used
less, perhaps. Right. It's been used a little less, so it might be a better term. I'm not going to personally try and campaign to change the way we use the language to describe these things, because I think it's an impossible battle. I just want to make sure we understand what we mean. We have to be clear. All right. That's my goal. Clarity. To try and clarify in our own minds. Okay. So, Okay. So, I'm not even never going to get up to the surface. I just wanted to point out these experiments, and this is how Anne summarized these experiments. Her experimental points are the black points on this curve, and the black symbols, the open symbols, are all her points. And what she's done is sort of classified them according to the behavior, according to whether they were layered or mixed or what happened to them, with a buoyancy ratio. So we have a stronger density stratification going this direction on this plot. And then there's this important viscosity ratio between the domes and the overlying between the two materials. And so, like I said, she could independently vary those two things. And in the case of the domes, most of the dome experiments actually have the lower material being somewhat more viscous than the upper material. That's what makes it so easy for them to form these domes. And there's a clearly defined mixing regime. There's a sort of transition between domes and this hybrid, partly mixed material. And then there's a fully stratified, the stratified case. And the stratified case starts more or less when a buoyancy ratio is about 1. That's what I just said that we did with that other calculation, where essentially the thermal and chemical contributions to buoyancy are equal and opposite. And so once you get above there, you're starting to move into a fairly stably stratified situation. The red curve is an analytical analysis of when you should have mixing. You should have mixing according to sort of an analytical solution everywhere to the left of that curve, and you should not necessarily expect mixing everything to the right. And so it's nice that her experiments fit very well with the analytical things. So
when you do the numerical calculations, do you have realistic parameter numbers, for example, or do you try to duplicate the laboratory experiments?
I don't really try and duplicate the laboratory experiments, and that leads me right to my next point, which is I started looking a little bit to see what we had done in the numerical world along these lines, and that's what the colorful points are. But I want to caution you about taking the locations of these points too literally, because what I found when I started to read my own work and other people's works is that most of the work that's been done looking at stratified or thermochemical convection to try and understand this sort of process is usually each paper is aimed at understanding a specific problem, and so people outline what they've done in terms of that specific problem. They weren't necessarily interested in this viscosity ratio, for instance. So people may not report that if that's not what they're studying. Or most people report the buoyancy ratio pretty clearly. But figuring out, and of course people don't always, because this is this experimental work is relatively recent, people don't always use a word like dome to describe what they're seeing. They may not use the words, these same terms to describe it, the phenomenology that they're seeing. May be interested in just whether something is stratified or not, and not so much in these transitory structures. So I had to do some interpretation. I had to look at the pictures that people showed and say, that looks more like a dome to me than like a stratified layer, and so on. So so a little, you know, cautious in interpreting that. It's kind of an interesting thing to go through and do though. The sort of bluish-greenish points are the ones that fell into more or less the stratified or hybrid stratified regime. The yellow things were things that I thought looked strongly like domes. The red points were the ones where stuff overturned and mixed pretty rapidly. And the square points here were a couple of cases where people were studying other specific parameters. For instance, they might have been looking at depth-dependent changes in properties or something else that was contributing to, or looking at imposing a plate flow or something like that, something else that was contributing an additional factor. And so it was a little harder to categorize those particular calculations. But in the sort of general sense, there's actually pretty good agreement between the numerical calculations and the laboratory work. We don't have specific one-to-one matches between these things, so I can't tell you specifically whether we have one-to-one. That's right.
On a very high
mantle. Exactly. Yeah. So these were meant to study the mantle, and these were two, but they're using quite a different material. That was kind of interesting, but I think there's also a lot of stuff. There's a sort of rich area here to work on, and you might notice that there's actually a curve here. The models, as they heated up, those laboratory models changed. Sometimes they changed behavior with time, and so this is a trajectory of what a single model did. It started out stratified and moved into the hybrid regime and is heading towards mixing eventually. So then one has to ask the question, what kind of time scale is involved? If this is going to eventually overturn, how long is that going to take? And how would we relate that to the Earth? Okay, so that's an open kind of question.
The buoyancy ratio is delta rho.
Delta rho.
Over alpha delta t.
That's right. No, that's right. Yeah, so I think maybe one of those square points may be one that was heated from within. Yeah, there's a lot of variability. That's why I'm a little cautious about showing this graph. I did this for my own personal benefit, but then it seems useful to show in this context.
Things like coefficient of thermal expansion are constant?
I think I did not include any models that did not have that were not constant. Just for the purposes of this comparison.
The pressure is not considered all.
Except it might be in one of those square points. Yeah, but those are the ones that have other factors. And then I sort of stopped looking at models that had other factors.
Can you remind, well, me and maybe some other people in the audience, what the buoyancy ratio is?
The buoyancy ratio is delta rho due to composition. So if you have two materials at the same temperature, delta rho between those two materials normalized to rho alpha delta t. So normalized to the delta rho due to the maximum temperature variation in the system. So a buoyancy ratio of 1 means that, for instance, in this sort of situation would mean that the material at the bottom is the same density as the material at the very top, which is cold. The cold sort of dense material is the same as the material at the top. Yeah.
Could you define mixing or tell us what mixing is?
Right. That's a good question. Okay, so I'm sort of reporting on someone else's definition of mixing, but in this case, mixing really means that it completely that there was a complete overturn, and that the two layers did not stay in any way isolated from each other. Now, there was no point, I think, in these sorts of experiments of running it to complete homogenization, because that's not what she was aiming to study. And in fact, most of the time when people are studying two-layered convection, they don't bother. But once you have one overturn, it's pretty much going to continue mixing. So you can say that probably if this dome continued around, that would be mixing. This one is mixing because the blue material is making a complete circuit. Okay, well, I'm out of time. So I wanted to say a couple of things about what happens at the surface though, because I think it's useful to do this. And so again, let me mention that when numerical models or laboratory models try and study plumes, we typically try and look at, we try to isolate some properties and look at some phenomenology of, you know, look at the effect of one or two things or maybe half a dozen things on the structure of the plumes and try and get something that we can observe. This is, I want to point you to the work by Farnatani and et al., Samuel and Farnatani, and Farnatani and Samuel are some a sequence of papers that have come out in recent years that have done some very nice numerical work on mantle plumes, looking at how tracers behave in these plumes. So so here's a one model. This is a uniform mantle, so this is a kind of base model. It's an axisymmetric calculation, and she's introduced some tracers in here, and the tracers are color-coded according to where they started out in the lower boundary layer. So if you were looking at what Don DiPaolo showed us yesterday about the stuff being entrained, coming in from the boundary layer and then coming up in a narrow pipe, if you wanted to get really detailed about where exactly that stuff originated, it's been color-coded in this particular model to show you that. And so the top there is the temperature, and you can see the plume coming up and spreading out. The bottom here is those tracer particles, and then this is just a blow-up of it, which shows you the detailed structure of where that material comes from. And again, you can see that the blue here, or the purplish material here, comes up and spreads out, but the core of the plume is basically formed all of this material from the base. So the kind of, you were talking about the oscillating, or the variations in time of various, you know, tracers, helium, I think is the one you mentioned. Well, that might be, the source region might be one origin of that. I'm sure you are. And then we have some more complex models. This has a model in which there's a dense layer at the base, so she's looking at how a dense deatable prime would be pulled in, and there's low viscosity in the plume, and also there's now we have some depth dependence in the sense that there's a transition to higher viscosity in the transition zone, which is what we would expect. And this is just
one of her primary points in the latter model that you no longer have these very high excess temperatures.
Yeah, that's right. This is considerably cooler here. It's not as red because of that. That's right. The hottest part of the boundary is staying down there, and you can see that in this bottom stuff. You don't see much of the black stuff here coming up. It's staying isolated. So that's again a situation where you're dragging some material up, but not all that much. And then she's looked in detail at this. This is a detail shot of the plume head, in which the particles, the black particles, are from the boundary layer, the basal boundary layer. These gray particles are what were pulled up through the transition zone, and the white zone there is a calculation of where you would expect melting to occur. So you would expect the volcanics to be extracted from that zone that's outlined by the white curve. And so this gives you a sense of where you'll have a mix of, you know, some material from the basal boundary layer and some from the surrounding area, and not much of this gray stuff. So you're not going to see too much of the surrounding material.
That's sort of the same mixing rate or volume rate as a normal military ridge, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it's hotter. I don't know.
But it's melting at the same depth and
same level.
I don't have a direct comparison of the equivalent, you know.
I think that's a very rough indication of where the melting
is. Right, it is. I mean, she's not introducing, there's, it's basically where the melting is expected. The melting doesn't then feed back into the system in any way.
I just would have thought it would be melting much deeper.
Apparently not.
I have a hard time seeing this gray tracer, is that that one?
That's that one band. The rest, these, I know, it's hard to see actually on this, on the screen. The black ones are the, are the, are these. This band is the main band of gray tracers. Okay. Let me. Sorry, Barbara, I promised to keep it short and I have not quite succeeded. all right, one more thing. This is a, you know, this is sort of another way. I mean, so this, these numerical models are looking in detail at the dynamics of a two-layered system. It, oftentimes it's very satisfying to take a kind of simpler approach and try and get, you know, get some what amount to back of the envelope calculations. These are more than back of the envelope calculations, but essentially, you know, a very, very simplified picture just to get a sense of time scales and length scales of processes. And so this is from Shiji Zhang. And this is an earlier version of something he's now published in Geophysical Journal International. So I'd encourage you to look at that, which has a lot more in-depth look at this problem. And what they're looking at is basically the problem of how rapidly would you deplete a layer like the D-double prime layer, or a larger layer like, you know, maybe a 1,000 kilometer thick layer at the base of the mantle by carrying it up in plumes. And they did this in a very simple way. By basically introducing a cylindrical plume with some buoyancy and introducing a hot, dense layer at the base and then looking at the carrying capacity. This sort of calculation was done in kind of a flat layer by Norm Sleep a number of years ago, around, I don't know, 88, 90-ish. And so this is extending that a little bit. And they've carried out a series of calculations, again, where they vary what amounts to the buoyancy ratio. That's the density contrast in the dense material at the base versus the density contrast in the plumes. That's equivalent to the buoyancy ratio for a variety of plume width diameters. So we have a bunch of plume diameters. All of this is in dimensionless numbers, and so then you have to figure out how to turn it back into dimensional numbers. And they have basically a volume rate of how much stuff is being pulled up per unit time for these various models. And they've done some work to scale this to a layer with a D-double prime sized layer, so a 200 kilometer thick layer with a, let's see, a density contrast in the plume of 100 and some viscosities there. And they find that basically a plume could tap out something like a D-double prime layer in 5 billion years or so, a big plume. If you make the layer a little bit bigger, then it can't, a 1,000 kilometer thick layer would not be tapped out at all in 5 billion years by one or even multiple plumes. So if you want to, you know, look at those domes or look at the carrying capacity of plumes, you would basically be trying to, you'd basically see that if this were the situation that we had, a dense layer at the base of the mantle that was being tapped by plumes, if it's D double prime, we need to replenish it from time to time, probably. And if it's you know, a larger layer, doesn't need to be replenished because it takes longer to empty it out. So it's a simple thing, but a nice kind of sense of what the time scale is involved. So I think I had better stop there so I don't cut into the coffee break and see what you guys have to say. I was going to, I'll just say, if anybody's interested later, I was going to talk a little bit about what happens when plumes get to the surface. Some models, I know you looked at the models last week of Christensen and Ribby, I think you did. And so you were looking at what happens when a plume intersects a plate. I have some models of when a plume intersects a mid-ocean ridge that are along this, in the same, done in the same spirit, basically to look at how the plume spreads out along the ridge. And if somebody wants to talk, what?
Do you
I do have that in this presentation.
Yeah,
All right. Squeaky wheel gets the grease.
It's either now or later.
It's either now or later. Well, that's true, I guess. Or never. Okay. Oops. I'm just trying to get this. This is older work, so I don't have it on PowerPoint. But basically, the idea is to try and understand this, which is that the when you look at the sort of compositional signature of a hotspot like Iceland, what you typically see is that it extends a little bit beyond the island itself and onto the surrounding the neighboring ridge. And it turns out that these have been studied in extensive detail, and you can sort of map a length scale for this sort of extension, this sort of influence of the plume, if you will, on the surrounding mantle, the surrounding ridge. And we were interested in studying this. So I worked with Mark Feigner, who did a PhD at Berkeley looking at this problem. Looking at it with a tank. And we decided to do the direct comparison between the tank experiments and the just cut to the chase here. And the tank experiments and a numerical experiment. And we did that this way. So again, this is in the spirit of doing the simplest possible calculation that will give you information about a process. And in this particular calculation, what we did is we introduced a hockey puck source of buoyant material, which rises up into a box. This is fully 3D. And to mimic the spreading center, we introduced basically a divergent boundary condition on the surface. And the way the laboratory experiments were done were very similar. There was a hockey puck source of buoyancy, of heat, and then mylar sheets that went onto rollers to simulate the spreading center. So it's a very clever experiment. And as you can see, the material starts to rise up and spreads out. And eventually, what happens is that the material, the buoyant material, is pulled away by the plates, and it spreads out along the ridge. But there's a trade-off between the rate at which this plate is spreading and the rate at which it spreads out along the ridge. And so you end up with a kind of steady state, what's called a waste width, which is basically the influence of the plume, in this case, it really truly a plume, on the ridge. And that's shown in this time series here, where you see the arrival of the plume, and it spreads out, and then it kind of settles down to a steady state. And we did a series of calculations like this to show that effect. And the nice thing about that is that that's all dimensionless, of course, but we could compare this dimensionless waste width that we got from the numerical experiments to the waste width that was measured in the laboratory experiments. And in the case of the numerical experiments, this dimensionless thing converges on a number 1.8, which I'll show you in a second how to turn back into a real dimensional number. And in the case of the laboratory experiments, there's some scatter here, but it's about 2.1. And so, you know, that's not too bad, actually, for that sort of comparison. The time here, this time, is the amount of time that it takes for it to reach that steady state. And so the more buoyant the plume is, basically the faster that happens. So more buoyant plumes come up and spread out quickly and settle down quickly. And when we scale that back to time, it's a little bit complicated, but basically our waste, and I'll just show you the bottom line. The waste width depends on the upwelling plume flux and the plate velocity in some way, and we can use something similar with viscosity enters in here too to scale the time. But that allows us to basically take those waste widths and calculate and use the measured ones from geochemical things data to try and get some idea of how long it should take before these things reach steady state, and also to get some idea of the volumetric flux of plumes. And so we took several several ridge-centered hotspots and looked at them, and looked at the volumetric flux that we calculated. And this is the sort of volumetric flux from, actually from Zhang-Yi Shilling, I think is quoting somebody else. But what you see, one thing you see about this is that we get a larger number than the other estimates. So our estimate based on these experiments is somewhat overestimating the flux, the plume flux, and it's giving us basically a larger signature. Now this was done, as I said, in a somewhat kind of simplifying way. It was done primarily with buoyant. This is actually a chemically buoyant plume, which is the equivalent of a chemically buoyant plume that was done in the tank experiments. In other words, in the tank, they were injecting a sort of syrup that had a lighter buoyancy into things. So our numerical model is equivalent to the laboratory experiments. It doesn't include really a temperature in there. So our chemical tracers and our temperature anomaly are one and the same in this case. And it would be interesting to go back and redo this and make it a little bit more advanced to try and take into account the multiple factors that are affecting the dynamics. Yeah.
One of the biggest
misfits
here is Galapagos.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think Galapagos is probably doesn't belong in this because of that because it's more complex geometry. It's much more complex geometry than what we have. The others, Iceland, it's actually one of the closest matches, and it's. It's also where you'd expect it to be the best, where you'd expect this model to do the best job. So, all right, that was the fast version.
The volumetric fluxes are much different from Hawaii. I think Hawaii is in that same.
No, they're not. I mean, they're not out of. They're not.
But I mean, Hawaii is not hugely different from them. It's not a lot bigger.
Right.
The volumetric flux.
So, what do you conclude from that?
That we shouldn't think of Hawaii as being a whole lot different.
From anything else. Okay. It's just not on a ridge, right? So you're not going to be able to do this kind of analysis for it with it.
No, but you can use the swell.
You can use the swell. And effectively, this is another way of using something like the swell. It's just using the chemical signature. All right. Why don't I stop there and see if you have any more questions than you've already asked.